Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm honored to be here this morning and now terrified to try and share my screen. Let's see if this is going to work. I got coaching from George earlier, so thank you, George, for that. Okay. I'm going to, this morning, talk about some people, ideas about people without homes, and then the systems around our area here and what mostly isn't working. But the first thing I'd like to do, and my screen is covering some of the words, so let's see if I can, there we go. You know, after World War II, there was, it seems like some hope for change and making things better. And I came across this the other day, which kind of identifies a goal of everyone having a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food and clothing, housing and medical care, and the necessary social services and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in the circumstances beyond his control. That was in the UN 1948. And I was kind of surprised to see that. We've got a long, long way to go. But it does a nice job of summarizing what we should be striving for and remembering. Okay, so the this position is got some parts to it where that what I do is I meet people without homes, mostly in the city of Mount Vernon. I am a city employee. So that doesn't mean that if I cross the bridge into Burlington, my tires crumble under me. I can mostly I am working with people in Mount Vernon and helping them work on some goals. And then also another part of it is I am a silo buster. Everybody is in their own silo, the mental health system, substance use, legal, physical health. It's incredibly hard for people to talk. And because this position is I'm not bound by HIPAA. I'm not doing any treatment or diagnosing. I can talk to different people. I mean, I get ROIs when I can, but and I don't share lots of deep information, but I can link people together. So that's been a big help. And then I present to community groups when I'm invited. So outreach is a lot like remodeling your bathroom. And you know, you start your bathroom and you pull out all of the flooring and the old fixtures, and then you order new ones, and it takes a lot longer than you think to get it delivered. And you find out you have some mold in there and you have to dig deeper. And it's just always a slower process than you expect. And outreach is that way too. I'm just stunned at how long it can take for the systems to work together as well as the people to believe that they can have a better life. And if we have time, we'll go over one story. I'm not sure we'll have that, but it just takes a long time for people to have any positive resolution. A few of the facts that I like to bring to highlight is the first one is in 2019, 567,715 people experienced homelessness in the US. And in Washington State, it was 21,577. And in and around Mount Vernon, I believe Community Action says that it's either 1,300 or 1,600 people qualify for services in this county. We have a point in time count that the nation does, but here we don't have enough volunteers, and it is very difficult to find people in January when the count occurs to count them. So our point in time count is not as accurate, I think, as the community action numbers. The figures nationally, and what I've also found here, is about 60% of the people without homes have a mental health issue or a substance use issue or both. And it certainly can develop once you're on the street too. And it's just so incredibly difficult to access services and continue them when you don't have a home. And that means that 40% of the people without homes don't have those issues. They may have jobs and are trying to hold their families together, but they can't afford a place to live. And 99, almost everybody wants to live indoors. You know, people when this position was first created, people would say, well, you know, they're choosing to live outside. And that's something that people all over the place, some people believe. And I used to say that out of all 400 people I've met so far, there were two who really did truly want to live outdoors. And then one of those people got enough money to buy a van, and then he was sleeping in his van. So he actually didn't want to be outdoors. So I know one person so far who really, really does want to live outdoors. If I had an apartment in my pocket and I could offer that to somebody, everybody, they would all take it. We're hardwired to have a home and a place where we can let down our guard. And our people out there can't do that. And then the last point here I wanted to highlight is there's an organization called Mental Health America, and it's all over the country. It's my former employer, and they analyze the mental health, the quality of mental health services across the country. And Washington State ranks 45th in the country for having enough mental health services for all the people who want it. I see that every single day here. It takes people to access mental health services. You have to first have an assessment at an agency. And if you have one at one agency and for whatever reason you want to go to another agency, you have to wait to have the same assessment over there. It takes a month to see it's not even that. Some agencies say you have to see a therapist a couple times before you can see a prescriber. So that could be 2 months or 3 months out before you can see a prescriber. If you happen to have been in a mental health hospital and had meds and you weren't actually tied into a mental health agency, and you get discharged and you don't have meds, you're going to go 2 to 3 months at the shortest before you can continue those medications that may have helped you in the hospital. If you miss your appointments at a place, you're disenrolled after a certain amount of time, and then you have to start the whole thing over again. It's amazing here. I'm from Southern California, and it just was a big difference here in the mental health services. And what happens, and then there's not enough staff. Many of the agencies have openings because the salaries are so low for people too. And what happens then for everybody is traumatized by these systems. The people who do want to provide care are get compassion fatigue and secondary trauma. And then the people who do want the services are not able to access them as much as they need to. So those are some facts. What I'd also like to talk about is the people out there on the streets. You know, you all actually may know all of this already. There's so many reasons why people lose their homes. They have medical bills that they can't pay, and they can't pay the rent. The rents go up, you know, in this state so much that people then end up being evicted. Substance use, domestic violence, mental health stuff. You know, when I first came to, I met people who had, they were living in places, maybe with family or roommates, and they just decided that they wanted to not live with in that situation anymore. And so then they just left, and they didn't realize how hard it is now here to find places, another place to live. So they became homeless, and they were shocked because I guess Skagit, it wasn't that hard back in the day. And now it really is hard here to find places to live. I've met all kinds of amazing people. I've met a airline pilot and a arborist and a nurse and all sorts of different people who have had terrible luck and some bad things happen to them, and they've ended up without homes. So it's all kinds of folks out there who don't have a home. And another interesting fact is that this is a community action figure, but it's the same that roughly that I've met too. Most people are from Skagit County. People have also said to me, why can't we send people back to where they, from whence they came? And most of them are from here. And plus, sending somebody back to where they're from, if there's over 500,000 people homeless in the country, then those folks may end up back here too. So it obviously is a national problem that we have to address. And some of the people the officers have known, grew up with, they know their families, and they've seen them in school. They worked with them at restaurants in jobs before. And so lots of our folks are our neighbors and in our community. And so there's a doctor from Canada, Gabor Mate, who's written a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And he says that lots of people, I can't see it, who are addicted have extraordinarily high percentage of childhood traumas. And I'll go more into that in a second here. So childhood trauma really affects brain development, and that makes you more vulnerable to lots of other illnesses. And so there's a adverse childhood experiences study. It started in the 90s with a Kaiser doctor, and he was doing a weight clinic and helping people lose weight. And some of these people didn't lose the weight like they had thought they could. And he started to ask, got curious about these folks, and he started asking questions. And he said, one of the questions he asked was, how old were you when you first had sex? And some people said 8 or 12. And this opened up a study of all of the things that have happened to people. And if there's been domestic violence in the home, a family person with mental illness, somebody's gone to jail, various things like that, then the more of those things that a child is around growing up, then the more vulnerable they become to mental health issues, substance use issues, smoking, obesity, stuff like that. So since the 90s, we've really started to learn a lot about brain development and why one person is more susceptible to drug addiction than another. And then Gabor Mate said this too, addiction always begins with some sort of pain, either emotional pain or physical pain. So after I read that, I thought I'm going to test this out. And I would say that to people, my new friends without homes, and every one of them would stop and get silent. And then they would say the time that they lost their grandmother, who was the only person who cared about them, or that they had a car accident and they hurt or killed somebody, and they couldn't handle that emotionally. So our neighbors on the streets have had some terrible, terrible experiences that are hard to heal from, but can. So what I do, when I first started the job, the first thing on the job description was to help people find homes, which here in Skagit, as you all know, we have a 0% vacancy rate. So I'm not doing much of that. And so what I try and focus on is helping develop or maintain somebody's resilience. So there were studies about kids with resilience, and like a similar bad thing would happen to two kids, and one kid could bounce back from it and one kid couldn't. And so researchers were interested in that, and they've coined the term resilience, and there's other protective factors, things like that. For if you have a lot of these, you'll be able to bounce back from bad things that happen, because bad things happen to everybody. So I help, I focus on these six areas. I can help people get jobs. We can buy them boots for their job, or help them do resumes and drive. Well, I used to be able to drive people around, and I will get back to that again and take them to interviews. Or their SSI or SSDI needs untangling, so I can help with that. I've helped a few people find homes, and obviously we'll continue to do that. I do the housing assessments for community action for the people I know, and then I'm the point of contact for them when they need to be called. I have access to the police databases for finding humans, so if somebody is looking for their family members, I can look for them and write them letters and see if they want to reconnect with their family member here. So just having somebody else that cares about them is something I do a lot of, until they can find their own community of people who care about them. There was one guy I met who he had been in an apartment that caught on fire. And so he left, and he was super grumpy and yelly. And the police he was staying in his car, and they would ask him to move to another area, and he would just super cuss them out. And so the police thought that I would be a good person for him to talk to. So I started chatting with him, and he had a phenomenal way of insulting people. It was super clever and very creative. But we started talking, and he was a vet, and helped him reconnect to community action. And he was getting another apartment, but they put him in a hotel first. But he was still calling me, because he really needed someone to talk to just about the strange goings on in the hotel at the time. And so I provide a caring ear for people. And then a meaningful role, a positive, meaningful role. Everybody wants that. You know, nobody starts off saying, I want to be crazy, or I want to be a drug addict, or I want to be a transient. So helping somebody find a positive, meaningful role in the community, lots of times that's working or school, but it can also be having a role in their 12-step meeting, or finding a faith-based community, which is also the last part. In social work school, nobody talked about how important spirituality is for most people. And a lot of the folks out on the streets believe that God turned his or her back on them. And so, and it means a lot to people. So talking about what other faith-based communities and how they can access that is something I help with also. So this is the part of that I feel compelled to tell everyone when I'm in front of groups, because I think this is vitally important. I just spoke about the 90s being a new time to learn about brains, and that's because of MRIs. We started to use them to watch people's brains as they're processing information. Before that, you could only study them when they were no longer attached to somebody's body. So now we've learned lots of things about people's brains who have drug addiction. And one of the parts is that drug addiction affects lots of parts of your brain, but the part I'm going to talk about is the prefrontal cortex, the front part of your brain, and it changes the structures of their brains, physically changes the structure of their brains. So in our brains, we all have a go switch. It's an ancient part of our brain, and that's where the part that makes us hungry and thirsty and want to procreate. And so you drink water when you're thirsty and you eat, and if it's working properly, well, so we all have that switch. It's the go switch. And this switch in people's brains that have drug addiction is broken and it's stuck on. So this is the idea of, if two donuts are good, then six are better. And then we also have a stop switch, which is where we can resist impulses and have compassion for other people. And that part of the brain is stuck off. So the on switch is on all the time, and there is no stop switch to say, stop eating so many donuts, Aaron. So these are real things, and it is documented in researchers' journals. And so it's time for us to all stop saying that it's their choice to use drugs, because it isn't. It may have been the very first time they did it, but we talked about the ACEs study. So if you're a child who had lots of things happening to you that lowers your protective factors, and then you use drugs, you're going to be predisposed to having a drug addiction or a mental illness. So the Surgeon General has said this in 2016, talk about a cultural shift in how we view addiction. And it's not a moral failing. And I just have to say that anytime I'm invited anywhere, which I don't get invited to many parties anymore. okay, so I went to a presentation of a doctor, and he used this slide, which is not very good, and I apologize, but it will demonstrate the point. The middle, these are people's brains, and the middle line is, the top line is a normal person who doesn't have a drug addiction, and that's their brain activity when they're thinking about some puzzle or process. The middle brain is people after 10 days of abstinence. So they haven't used drugs for 10 days. They don't have very much prefrontal activity or brain activity when they're working on thinking about an idea or a puzzle. And then the bottom one is after 100 days of no drug use. So it's still a long way off from the normal brain. A long way off. And why this is important is because the speaker was a doctor who had a substance use issue of his own, and he had to go into a monitored program so that he could keep his license. And he said that for doctors and pilots, airline pilots, there is a phenomenal program to help people stay sober. And it isn't, he was lucky enough to go into a fancy 90-day detox that he spent $27,000 of his own money. And then he moved into another program that took a whole year for him to, before he could graduate from it. And he said that tracking pilots and doctors, they have a 70% success rate for staying sober when using these programs, a long-term, over a year-long participation. 70%, that's huge. And so it shows that it's very possible. Here in this state, and pretty much anywhere, I think, if you have Medicaid and you want to have inpatient substance use treatment, it is normally for 30 days, 30 whole days. It's not close to a year at all. So we're a long way away from being able to provide adequate treatment for people to get back to normalness. And I have to slow this up again. Here we go. So some of the things that, that people who don't have insight into how, you know, what you need to insight into how these systems work, you know, think they can just, it, you know, all they need is a job. They just need to get off their butts and get work into. So even things like getting an ID. So you lose your ID and you need another one and you don't have a home. And so you use general delivery to get your mail. When you apply for a new ID, it is mailed somewhere. And if you pick up your mail at general delivery, you have to have an ID to pick up your mail. So just that alone is, so when I help people, we have it mailed to the police department and then go from there. If you need a birth certificate because you haven't had an ID for a while or you haven't had one in the state and you're applying for a birth certificate, lots of the states require that your signature is notarized. And to have your signature notarized, you need an ID. So the police department here has, we've worked that out so that people can't, we can verify people's signatures so they can get their birth certificates. So just that thing, which, you know, you think it's pretty easy to get an ID. And then access to services, I spoke a little about just getting, the substance use services here require an assessment from a chemical dependency professional, a CDP, and so there aren't enough of them. So you have to wait to get an assessment. And then once you have an assessment, it isn't that long before a bed opens up in an inpatient program. It could be maybe a week, sometimes less. So that part isn't as difficult, but getting the assessment can be very challenging. When I first came here, there were people in the jail who could do that, and that was super great. And then we're short-staffed everywhere, so there's a big wait list for people to have their assessments done in the jail, and so lots of people get released. Oh, which reminds me, I forgot to point this fact out, too. In 2017, the Skagit County Health Department did an evaluation of people who graduated from inpatient treatment, and they found that here, that in this state, 50% of the people who graduate from that whole 30 days there are discharged back to the streets. So, you know, I meet people and they've told me they've gone to treatment four or five times for that 30 days. And then at some point, sometimes, you know, they're like, what's the point of that? So we need more, we need lots of housing and we need more Oxford houses and places where people can kind of continue their year-long recovery. Okay. And then there are five courts here in this community. And they're all on different days. This was pre-COVID. Well, it's still true. Now it's even more confusing because some, you know, how you get to court, get to a video, a phone or an iPad or something is hard. But before that, you know, it could be all over the place. Superior Court, District Court, Burlington Municipal, Skagit, Mount Vernon Municipal, and Anacortes Municipal, and Cedar Woolley. Actually, that's six. So it's just complicated. And I used to have people in my car who, when they realized that they had to go to court, just drive very appropriately the speed limit always to court in Cedar Woolley or Anacortes or wherever we were going. So just those challenges. And then the housing, the 0% vacancy rate, what that means here is that for every open apartment, about 50 people apply. And so there's lots of people who qualify financially more than the folks without incomes. If you have a Section 8 certificate, it's still very difficult to find a place. In Anacortes, I was looking a while ago, and a studio apartment goes for $875 U.S. dollars. And that's lots of people who have SSI, it's around $750. dollars. So it's just very, very difficult for people to find a place to live. Even a room for rent is like $600 around here. So just extremely challenging. Let's see. How much time do we have left? 5 minutes? Is that of talking?
I think you can take 5 minutes more. Yes.
Well, I'm going to go really fast through this. This is a path. It starts in the top left-hand corner, and it goes to the bottom left-hand corner, and it's a road. Even though my boss thinks it really looks like an intestine, it's a road. and so I met Daryl in 2017 on the streets in April, and he was in a wheelchair. He has spina bifida, and he had a colostomy bag. And we did the housing assessment in April. He was on the streets, so it's very hard to find him when I had a plan or needed to talk to him. He went to the hospital in May, and then he got an apartment in around July 12th or something like that. And then through August through November, he had people living with him because people who were on the streets have survivor's guilt. Now they have their own place, and they feel they don't understand why their friends who helped them out can't stay with them. We couldn't find an in-home worker for him in November. And then in April, and he was not answering the door so much for a while. And then in April of the next year, gang members had moved in, and they moved into his bedroom, which had where the bathroom was, and they forced him to live in the front room only. And so my coworkers, very handily, we went over there with the police, and they not only kicked them out, but they arrested them because they had some warrants. So, but he got evicted. So in June, he was back on the streets. And then people took advantage of him and would take his money and roll him out to the woods. It was hard to find him, but then he started going to the Reach Center. So, I got to see him more. But it's winter time. And so he ended up in the hospital on December 11th of 2018, and he lost both of his feet from frostbite and other things. So he was recovering in there, and then he went to an adult family home in Bellingham, but he got kicked out of there. I did a little wiggly wrong. Anyway, he was kicked out, and then he was back on the streets. I'm kind of skipping to the middle of the screen. He would end up in the hospital a lot. And so finally in June 27th, we got everybody together, all the systems. This is that silo busting part, Skagit Valley Hospital, the medical director there, DSHS, Northwest Regional Council, the fire department, the police department. We all got together and made a plan for Daryl so that he could eventually get off the streets. And that involved getting him back to the hospital, and they kept him there. Here's another thing. An adult family home gets paid through the state, and if you don't rate high enough, you won't have enough rent money to go there. So Daryl had to go to the hospital. The highest rate you can get is if you spend time in the hospital while you're assessed. So the medical director agreed to keep him there while we found a place for him. And he had smoked meth. And so lots of the adult family homes turn him down. They can just say they don't want that a person who's ever done drugs, which is complicated. So the hospital kept him and paid for him to stay there until we could find an adult family home that would accept him. And I'm speeding through it because we're short on time, but the very bottom row, we found one down in Kent. We had to take him down there so he would see it because he's a born in Skagit. He didn't want to leave. He checked it out, and he made friends down there immediately. And so he agreed to go. And finally, 2 years later, October 15th, 3 years later, he is in an adult family home, and he's still there. So that's just one example of how long it takes to get somebody into an appropriate setting. So that's just to leave on a things are happening positively here. More and more people are aware and care about this situation in this area. We do have a winter shelter. This year it's in a hotel, but for the so people do have some opportunities to be indoors. There's a permanent supportive housing apartment building. It's going to be 70 units that's being built. The city did pass an ordinance for safe parking. We haven't had a church able to make that happen yet, but it's still on the books. And so it's very slow, but it's at least moving. And the state legislators do know how terrible the mental health system is here. And so they're working on that too. So there is hope. That's my the poem that reminds me that we're all in the same boat. So thank you. And anybody have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.